You're listening to ABC Radio National's MP3 and podcast of Background Briefing. Find out more, go to abc.net.au/rn.
This is Background Briefing on ABC Radio National. I'm Kirsten Garrett, and here now is a mystery voice.
For Italy,
see if you can guess.
It was not their high gross
a clue. He's an economist.
And let us bear in mind that William Shakespeare was the product of a country with a very low gross national product or a gross domestic product. Let us realize that there are achievements, very great achievements, that are outside of the field of economics. Let us bear in mind that Darwin, who had an enormous effect on all social thought, was not equipped with a large remunerative staff. We have a large range of artistic and scientific achievement which still depend on separate human intelligence.
It's John Kenneth Galbraith speaking in August 2002, when he was 93 years old. This year he'll turn 97 and still going strong. And a biography of him has just been released, written by his friend and fellow economist Richard Parker. Galbraith himself has written 48 books, many of them bestsellers. He's been a hugely influential political economist all his life, and though his Keynesian economics are no longer dominant, Galbraith remains a revered figure. He's still intellectually active and maintains that economics is anything but a dismal and desiccated science. Over a long lifetime, he's been given no less than 52 PhDs from places like Oxford and Harvard and the Sorbonne. Galbraith's biographer, Richard Parker, was one of the founders of the Atlantic Monthly magazine, and he's also an economist and he teaches at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Richard Parker, like Galbraith, calls himself an unapologetic Democrat. And he gave a talk about Galbraith's life at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco some weeks ago. This today is an edited version of that talk, and later in the program you'll hear more from J.K. Galbraith himself.
It's important to understand that Ken was not born to the manor, despite the style which many of you have seen him display. He's the son of a small-town Canadian farmer and his wife, born in rural Ontario at the dawn of the 20th century, upstairs in a farmhouse. He went to a one-room schoolhouse for the first 8 years of his life and graduated ultimately from Ontario Agriculture College with a major in animal husbandry. Many years later, he was invited back to OAC to receive an honorary degree, and in the process was interviewed by Time magazine, and in typical Galbraithian fashion, remarked that in his day he thought that OAC had been the cheapest and worst university in the English-speaking language. There was some umbrage taken, as you might imagine, by the alumni and administration. And on second thought, Galbraith thought it best to recant, and so he did it. But again, in typically Galbraithian fashion, he contacted Time magazine and said that he wished to apologize. He had, in fact, realized that undoubtedly Arkansas A&M was a worse college, but simply hadn't been certain that they spoke English. That sense of humor, that wit, was not intrinsic to Galbraith, but an inheritance from his father, Archie Galbraith, a figure of some prominence in local Ontario politics, a stalwart of the Canadian Liberal Party for many years. And it was from Archie that Ken first learned the importance of taking a stand in one's life when it came to matters of great import to the community. It was not, though, however, just inheritance, but early on experience that made Galbraith the man he was. He came here to California as the Depression was unfolding. Herbert Hoover was in the White House, and Franklin Roosevelt had not yet announced his candidacy. He saw men and women living in shanty towns. He was, in fact, a graduate student at Berkeley when the great San Francisco strike broke out here. And he has vivid memories of that conflict, as well as the numerous demonstrations that were held even then in the 1930s on the campus at Berkeley. He took from that college experience a formation of commitments that were to serve him the rest of his life. His first job out of graduate school when he graduated in 1934 was to be as a young instructor at Harvard University. But he simultaneously took up a first summer's job working in Washington for Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. And it was there, he said, that he acquired his first searing lesson in the importance of never imagining that economics is very far away from politics, or the questions of politics and economics far away from the question of power. That summer, President Roosevelt's program to lift agricultural prices, the initial payments of crop supports to farmers who did not plant, that was meant to bring up farm incomes and stabilize the suffering of so many millions of American farmers, was getting underway. And it was working well for the wheat farmers. It was working well for the cotton farmers. But in the summer of 1934, a question arose of quite significant magnitude for the New Deal and for liberalism itself. And the question was about cotton. And the question was, who should receive the federal government's money for not planting cotton? There were two groups. One was a handful of wealthy white plantation owners. The other was a much larger group, African American and white alike, of sharecroppers and tenant farmers who did all the work of raising cotton. And there was, of course, a division about who should receive millions upon millions of dollars from the federal government to alleviate the suffering in the cotton belt of the United States. And Galbraith vividly recalls a young colleague being summoned from the Agricultural Adjustment Administration up to Capitol Hill to meet with Cotton Ed Smith, senior senator from the state of South Carolina, chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee, and by coincidence himself a plantation owner of some significance in South Carolina. And the words that Cotton Ed Smith shared with that young lawyer, which the lawyer then shared with Galbraith a few hours later that same day, have always stayed with Professor Galbraith. Cotton Ed Smith said, "You take care of the payments, we'll take care of the niggers." It was for Galbraith in that moment, a Canadian, a white Canadian who'd grown up without the experience of racial politics, certainly the racial politics of the United States, a moment that never left him. But it also underscored for him the difficulties that liberalism in America faced, because ultimately Franklin Roosevelt gave in and made the payments to the plantation owners because the senior senators who were predominantly from the South, who controlled crucial committee chairs in the Senate, indicated to Roosevelt that they would simply bottle up Social Security. They would bottle up legislation reforming labor law. They would bottle up every other major piece of legislation that Roosevelt wanted to get through unless he cooperated with them on this issue, and so he did. Now, from that experience, Ken Galbraith didn't retreat. He didn't condemn politics. He didn't abandon liberalism. He didn't abandon conscience. He got to work. At Harvard, he quickly discovered John Maynard Keynes, the English economist whose general theory forms the cornerstone of all modern economics in policy and in theory. What was Keynes's innovation? Well, the economics that had been taught up until then is the one that still is taught in many ways to undergraduates today and is the one we hear echoed in the business press every time we open its pages or hear it on television or the radio, which is that markets left alone by government create the best of all possible economic worlds. Left alone, all factors of production, labor, capital, natural resources will be efficiently allocated by the mechanism of price. And there really is no significant function for government to play in that, and when it does attempt to enter into market relations, of course, it mucks them up and makes things worse, not better. But at the height of the Depression, a quarter of Americans were out of work. The stock market had fallen by 90%. It was literally like Flanders Field in many parts of the country economically. And in this situation, Keynes, who himself had been trained in that earlier conservative tradition, said, there is an alternative. And it is that in times of recession, government, by issuing bonds and taking the revenue from those bonds and spending those bonds to stimulate growth, putting money in workers' hands, which was then spent in shops, which then encouraged businessmen to hire, which then encouraged investors to invest, could form a virtuous circle of cooperation between government and the economy in a way that would absolutely transform the extraordinary up and down roller coaster ride that capitalism had been up until that point. And it is, of course, the world that we have by and large lived in. In a moment, I'll talk to you about what has been talked about as a transformation of that world in the last 30 years and say something else to you about it through Galbraith's eyes.
This is Background Briefing on ABC Radio National. You're listening to an edited version of a talk given by Richard Parker about his biography of J.K. Galbraith.
What you need to understand is that beginning in the 1930s, Americans, like citizens throughout the industrialized West, accepted the central responsibility of government for managing the economies in which they lived. Not just to maintain the macro levels of production that led toward full employment, but also to provide for minimal, in fact, significant networks of social justice and social capital that left the entire society better off than it had been, despite all the errors, all the wastage, and all the malfeasance that does go on in the public sector. Galbraith, learning that lesson from Keynes, was hired at the beginning of the Second World War for an extraordinary job by Franklin Roosevelt. At the age of 32, he became the price czar of the American economy. That is, he was put in charge at that age of making sure that when America went to war, that inflation did not break out and cripple the economy as extraordinary demands were placed upon it for men and materiel that would surely tax an economy that had been languishing for more than a decade. And you know what? He did a terrific job. In the First World War, prices had soared in little more than 2 years by more than 80%. In the Second World War, under this brash 32-year-old from Harvard, from a one-room schoolhouse in rural Ontario, prices rose roughly 5% over the course of the war. It was a singular achievement. Now, it wasn't purely Keynesian in character, but it was another signal moment for Galbraith to learn what the appropriate relationship of government and the economy could be in producing successful prosperity for all. But it also taught him something about power again. He says that at the Office of Price Administration where he worked, because they were placing price controls on goods and services that could be charged in the United States, there was an endless stream of CEOs and lobbyists and congressmen willing to do the bidding of the lobbyists and the CEOs. And in these meetings, which took place regularly at his offices on an almost daily basis, these gentlemen would troop in and begin to make their case. And in the middle of the meeting, as he would look around, his fellow OPA officials would start to wiggle their fingers like this at one another, dead serious as they listened to the petitions, but quietly wiggling their fingers. And I said, well, Professor Galbraith, what was that all about? He said, don't you know the story of the ant colony? And I said, no. He said, well, one day a very hungry ant colony made a major discovery, an enormous pile of horse manure up the hill from the colony. And the queen ant sent her troops out to bring this large pile of manure back to the colony for provisioning. But as they maneuvered it down the hill, it began to roll on its own and grew faster and faster until there was an avalanche of horse manure about to pour down upon the ant colony. And the queen's antennae went out like this. And Galbraith said, you know what that means in ant language, don't you? Stop that horse shit. You mustn't, however, understand that Galbraith is simply anti-business or even anti-big business. One of the significant contributions that he made to American liberalism in the mid-20th century was to help it reconcile itself intellectually to the idea of scale in American business. He, in fact, has long believed that there is a useful role for large firms to play because they have much longer planning horizons. They have the ability to finance R&D. They have the wealth and the market influence to provide well for their employees compared to oftentimes what little can be provided by small and struggling business. But Galbraith also saw something remarkable happening in the 1950s as a result of the success of American business, not least American large business, in the post-war period. And it became, as I'm sure many of you know, the subject of his great book, The Affluent Society. And what it was, in a sense, was the taking up of a projection that John Maynard Keynes himself had made in the early 1930s, in which he foresaw the capacity of capitalism to overcome the fundamental issue of human want. That is, by the middle of the 20th century, the United States stood in a remarkable place in human history. For the first time, a significantly large society was composed of a majority of men and women and children who were not poor. We sometimes forget, in fact, we often forget how absolutely new that is in terms of human history. And for Galbraith, it presented, in typically Galbraithian understanding, both an opportunity and a peril. The opportunity, of course, was that with affluence, we could free ourselves, as Keynes had hoped would become the case, from the strictures of labor and production for the sake of production, that we could go on to become human beings who became part of a human society that lived for more than material goods and material ends. But there was also, of course, this enormous risk, which was that the systematic brilliance of the large American corporation in mastering the production process and in mastering the technology of the production of goods found itself needing advertising and branding and all the other characteristics of a modern, wants-driven society, ultimately treating the consumer not as the opposite side of a supply-demand relationship, but as the final leg in the production cycle. That is, the consumer needed to be managed to understand that he or she needed what the corporations produced as surely as workers on the line or middle managers supervising workers were managed in order to optimize their work as well, too. We, in fact, become one gigantic and endless chain of production in which the consumer's consumption is simply a precondition for the production of more. Now, Galbraith mocked the qualities of a society that misunderstood that the real needs of American society moving forward from the 1950s were not for bigger cars, not for bigger homes, not for more things to be privately consumed, but the construction of a public world that worked for all. A public world of public goods, of hospitals and medical systems that worked for all, of parks and recreation that were provided for all. Not just education, but first-rate, absolutely excellent education provided for all. These were the things that an affluent society owed itself, not more tail-finned automobiles, not the latest in avocado-trimmed refrigerators or burnt orange shag rugs, as many of you old enough to remember the 50s will recall. He, of course, was not then writing in a period when what I find to be the most striking metaphor of this new world had emerged. Today, though, he finds it as amusing as I do that we walk down the streets of America and encounter so many people with the same name: Calvin, Perry, Tommy Hilfiger. I had no idea there were so many Hilfigers living in the United States today. What an enormous migration of people this must have been. Here we are, as Americans, paying premium prices above the cost of the goods or the service that those goods provide in order to serve as billboards for a corporation. Galbraith didn't see this in the 1950s, but he cannot ignore it today. Now, the other thing that Galbraith saw is the growth in the 1950s of the American military. Galbraith has always understood, because he grew up in a period in American life before the Second World War in which we had no tradition of a large standing military force. You have to recall that in 1940, General Marshall, the Chief of Staff, Army Chief of Staff, went before President Roosevelt and told him that the United States Army, if war came, would be able to field perhaps 125 or 130,000 armed troops. The United States Army Air Corps at that time was still flying substantial numbers of biplanes as part of the defense of America. But after the Second World War, under the pressure of the Cold War, expenditure on the military grew so enormous, in fact, that half of all federal spending was for the Department of Defense. And it is, of course, kept going. As some of you may know, the Brookings Institution actually did a retrospective study of spending by the United States on military weaponry and on the military, and concluded that in current dollar terms, the United States since the Second World War has spent roughly $24 trillion on the military, with roughly one-third of that alone going just for nuclear weapons. Galbraith asks, what could we have done with $24 trillion? What different kind of society could we have been? What role could we have played in the world had those resources been freed up for other purposes? The question that raised in his mind then became central to the role he played in the Kennedy administration. Because, as you know, he was President Kennedy's ambassador to India, but also close friend and confidant. And there's a remarkable set of letters that goes back in those Kennedy administration years between the president and his ambassador that make for remarkable reading. What they are a record of an administration struggling not to go into Vietnam. Many of us long ago concluded that the Kennedy administration, the Johnson administration, and the Nixon administration, it was all one continuum. What we now know from declassified material that's in the book, is that contrary to the idea that Kennedy wanted to go into Vietnam, Kennedy, acting largely under advice from Ambassador Galbraith, was doing his utmost throughout his administration to keep us out. In November 1961, Maxwell Taylor, Kennedy's military advisor, and Walt Rostow, who was then deputy national security advisor, went out to Saigon. Both men were committed to U.S. actually going into Vietnam, as were most of Kennedy's senior advisors. And this is the tale, which is that they prepared a report out of that November 61 visit that called upon the president to make the first significant contribution of U.S. troops to Vietnam. But as Maxwell Taylor said in one of the recently declassified records of conversations that he had with Secretary McNamara, Secretary Rusk, and General Taylor, we can't move too quickly because the president is opposed.
This is Background Briefing on ABC Radio National, and the speaker is Richard Parker, who teaches public policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He's just published an authorized biography of J.K. Galbraith. The book is called John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. And today's program is an edited version of a talk given at the Commonwealth Club some weeks ago. At this point, Richard Parker is telling of how Galbraith, who was a confidant of President John Kennedy, was horrified when senior advisers Maxwell Taylor and Walt Rostow were trying to keep secret a report in which they argued that President Kennedy should take America to war in Vietnam.
Now, At the very moment that those two men return from Saigon and prepare to present this report to President Kennedy and ask him to make a national security finding that the United States had a significant national interest in Vietnam and should therefore introduce troops, John Kenneth Galbraith arrived back from New Delhi with Prime Minister Nehru on a state visit and got wind of what was going on. He'd known Walt Rostow for 20 years, and he'd not trusted Walt Rostow, and he didn't like Walt Rostow sitting that close to the president, but there it was, and so one had to do something about this rather than give up or cavil or wring one's hands. So immediately after the first meeting of the White House between President Kennedy and Prime Minister Nehru, Ambassador Galbraith simply walked over to Walt Rostow's office and said, "Walt, how are things going? I'd like to see a copy of the Taylor Report." Rostow was horrified. He said, "Ken, this is eyes only the President of the United States, top secret. You can't take a look at this report." Ken said, "That's nonsense, Walt. I have the same security clearance as a senior U.S. ambassador that you have as a national security advisor. I want to see the report." Rostow said, "No." And at that very moment, the phone rang in Rostow's office. And Rostow turned backward to answer the phone. And as he did, Galbraith, sitting on the opposite side of Rostow's desk, realized that the Taylor Commission report was sitting on the desk between the two men. Galbraith, 6'8", leans forward, picks up the report, stands and walks out of Rostow's office and the White House. Now, you can imagine what must have gone through Rostow's mind at that moment. But, of course, there was no way to send the Secret Service out to stop him. The press office was two doors down. And the headline in the next day's New York Times would have been, "United States Ambassador Arrested Leaving White House with Top Secret Documents." This was not something that Walt Rostow wanted the Kennedy administration to have any part in. Well, of course, what Galbraith does is read this document, realize what Kennedy's advisors are trying to get the president to do, and begins what amounts to a two-week-long struggle to get the president not to follow the advisor's advice. In details, which are described in the book, there is a back and forth over the next 2 weeks as the two sides contend. Galbraith almost alone against the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Advisor, the Deputy National Security Advisor, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the President's personal military advisor. Now, the remarkable thing is that Kennedy is on Galbraith's side. But when Galbraith and Kennedy start leaking to the press the dangers of this report, there is no outcry. This is November 1961. There was no outcry in Congress. There was no outcry from the public. There was no outcry in the press about the dangers of the United States going into this kind of foreign war without solid foundations that could explain its purposes to the American people and to the world at large. And in the now recovered minutes of the National Security Council meeting, in which the advisors try to press Kennedy forward, these minutes were lost for 25 years afterwards because they were the personal minutes of General Lyman Lemnitzer, the chief of staff, and the Pentagon Papers never saw them. They only came to light a few years ago after Lemnitzer died. There's a remarkable record. Each of the advisors presents the case for going in, and the president sits silent. Halfway through the two-hour meeting, you see the notes by Lemnitzer saying, "Attorney General," meaning Bobby Kennedy. The words are, "Don't you hear? No troops, no way, no fucking troops." And the president says at the end that his criteria for the commitment of American troops abroad to conflict are fourfold. The first is that there must be a clear rationale for their commitment that involves a direct threat to the United States and its citizens themselves. Second, that the United States should commit those troops only following the resolution of the Security Council authorizing those troops, just as the United States had done in the Korean War. Third, that the troops would be sent only as part of a multilateral force, not American troops alone, because without the commitment of one's allies, America would not stay the course. Finally, that the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of Defense owed the White House an exit strategy before we entered. Now, I would submit to you that there is relevance in those words by President Kennedy from November 1961 to the situation in which we find ourselves today. Because that was the advice that he was hearing from Ambassador Galbraith. And Ambassador Galbraith, because of his particular understanding of power and politics and economics, knew that the issue was not simply the danger of Vietnam as a foreign misadventure, but that the Vietnam War would ultimately lead to an overcommitment of U.S. troops that would ultimately endanger the United States economy by kicking off inflation and the very kinds of conditions that he had been able to prevent in the Second World War, but that we couldn't prevent with no declared state of war. That the failure of the economy and the failure of the war would risk tipping over not just the Kennedy administration, but American liberalism and the Keynesian economic experiment all at once. And 10 years after Kennedy told his advisors what he wanted, Richard Nixon was in the White House. And Richard Nixon declared himself publicly to be a Keynesian. And as Galbraith said, at that moment, I knew we had lost. As he once told a reporter in the early 1970s, Galbraith had a very vivid view of Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon had worked for Ken Galbraith as a young lawyer during the Second World War, a fact that Nixon had omitted from his resume for the next 35 years that he only admitted to when the New York Times found out about it and published the information. But in the early 1970s, there was a worldwide food shortage, and as you recall, Nixon started secretly selling wheat to the Russians. And as part of the question that was at hand, the open issue was there something to do with climate that might be causing this worldwide food shortage? And a brave young New York Times reporter went to Professor Galbraith at Harvard and asked Professor Galbraith, do you think that climate somehow explains the problems we're having in this situation? And Galbraith pulled himself up to his full height, and he said, young man, never blame the deity for anything as long as Richard Nixon is in the White House. That understanding would carry Galbraith forward over the next 30 years. As you understand, the kind of liberalism and the kind of Keynesianism that John Kenneth Galbraith represented have been in abeyance these last 30 years. But it's also important to understand what Galbraith's critique of these last 30 years have been, which is that we are not faced with a Republican Party of the kind that Galbraith grew up quite familiar with. This is not, despite its claims, a party of small government. This is a big government Republican Party. As Galbraith points out, right now, under George W. Bush, the United States government is larger as a percentage of gross national product than it ever was under Lyndon Johnson, ever was under John F. Kennedy, ever was under Franklin Roosevelt in the Depression. The only time government has taken a greater share of GDP was in the Second World War, when the purposes for that spending seemed clear. This is not a Republican Party that is, in fact, despite its protestations, a party of fiscal responsibility. Since 1980, nearly $7 trillion have been added to the U.S. public debt. This year, we will add another $500 billion. Next year, another $500 billion. We are caught right now in a topsy-turvy world in which Galbraith believes we are seeing a kind of utopian, radical republicanism that in some sense is the dark mirror of the excesses of the utopian lefts of the 1960s, and that it's the responsibility of American liberals and American moderates to serve as a pragmatic center to bring the country back in line with its traditional values, when it is this Republican Party that is, in the name of traditional values, overthrowing every one of them at every turn. Ken Galbraith, at 96, continues to write, continues to fight. President Clinton came to see him 3 weeks ago at his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Some of you may know that President Clinton gave Professor Galbraith the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. What you may not know is that Professor Galbraith is one of only two Americans ever to receive that award twice It was given to him by Harry Truman in 1946. Bill Clinton, as he left office, began writing Professor Galbraith, proposing that the two of them write a book on the future of American government. Ultimately, Professor Galbraith declined because of age and health, and because, although he won't say this directly, because I think they might have disagreed. What I can tell you is that there was a wonderful moment in the hour-long discussion at Professor Galbraith's home when, as only he could, he turned to Bill Clinton and said, "As I told Harry Truman, this country doesn't need two Republican parties." The legacy of John Kenneth Galbraith is not simply intellectual. It's not simply in terms of his public service. This is a man who has been rewarded well over his life. Academically, he served 42 years as a professor at Harvard University. His books have sold more than 8 million copies. He's the recipient of 52 honorary PhDs from Oxford, from Harvard, from the Sorbonne, from the LSE, from the University of California. He has been well honored in his life. The honor that I suggest we owe him is the honor we owe ourselves. To understand what his career has been about. It has been about commitment, it has been about conscience, and it has been about courage. These are traditional American values, and American liberals like Ken Galbraith have a noble history of nurturing and preserving and advancing them, and we ought to do likewise. Thank you.
Well, our thanks to Richard Parker, Senior Fellow at Shorenstein Center at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and author of John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics, for joining us. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating over a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.
But stay with Background Briefing, because Galbraith himself was interviewed by Philip Adams on Radio National's Late Night Live program in 2002. He was then 93. Philip Adams talked to Galbraith at his home in Boston, and here has asked him if, at such an age and with so many of his contemporaries gone, if Galbraith sometimes felt lonely.
No, not at all. I have lost a lot of my wartime contemporaries, but teaching at Harvard, you have a new generation coming along, and my son, James Kenneth Galbraith, is a professor at the University of Texas, and he in turn has a wide range of acquaintances, many of whom I've come to know, and the result is that while I miss the people with whom I was once associated, quite a few of my old associates are indeed still alive, and as I say, there's a very interesting younger generation that becomes available through the university and through life generally.
I know I'm not allowed to call Harvard a campus. I've got to call Harvard a yard. And on this yard, or in this yard, do you find many new generation scholars, academics, who are sympathetic to your view of economics, to the Keynesian view, to the idea of social justice and some vestige of a welfare state?
Oh, sure. There's no intergenerational difference there. I have a group of younger friends on the Harvard faculty who are just as vigorously in pursuit of social justice as I ever was, and for whom Keynes and the support role of aggregate demand and the role of the state is different in certainly in detail and in refinement, but not different in view from my own. I would say we have the same distribution as between conservatives and liberals, as between those who see a larger role for the state and those who see a smaller one. For those who are committed to classical theory and its mathematical formulations, it lends itself to mathematics, and others, that's been about the same in my whole lifetime.
J.K. Galbraith is talking to Philip Adams in 2002. The discussion, which lasted for nearly an hour, ranged over 50 years of modern history, including the Second World War and Galbraith's views of the many presidents whose terms in the White House he had observed. Philip Adams.
Years ago, I read a very fine book on American politics called Nixon Agonistes by Gary Wills at Chicago. For the first time, I heard someone say something good about the Eisenhower presidency. He regarded Eisenhower as a very successful president, pointing out, for example, that on his term of duty, no American was killed in a war. You also speak kindly of Eisenhower.
I say that Eisenhower is, by many of my liberal colleagues, underestimated. Roosevelt invented the welfare system, Social Security, responsibility of the state for the poor, the whole sense of community responsibility. And Ike came along afterward and accepted it. Roosevelt innovated, Truman continued, and Eisenhower confirmed. Then there was one other thing. Eisenhower came into office with a miserable war on his hands in Korea. Truman had been unwilling to negotiate an end to the war. And Ike went to Korea, as he said he would in the election, and negotiated an end to the war. Eisenhower, along with other things, got an end to a bloody, cruel conflict that needed very much to be brought to an end.
He's also responsible for identifying to your country and to the world the dangers of what he described as the military-industrial complex.
This is right. These were his last words in office, that the country faced the very great danger of the unity of military and private power, corporate power, and gave us the word, the military-industrial complex, the phrase. This was very important and very real because we did face that and have since.
Yes, it's still a factor, of course, isn't it? When we walked into this beautiful room with a shelf full of leather-bound versions of your editions of your books, or some of them at least, you indicated that your best book, your favourite book, was on the top shelf. And I looked around and couldn't find one of the famous titles at all. What I finally found was a book on Indian art, a book on Indian miniatures. This is my best book, you said. Why?
Well, that's perhaps an exaggeration. My best book was The New Industrial State and the Affluent Society. By those two books, I cherish. But there's a point here, and let's keep it in mind. We must not measure human achievement by economic production, by the gross national product. When spring comes, as we talk, and people head out of the United States for Italy, for Florence, it was not their high gross national product that attracted them. And let us bear in mind that William Shakespeare was the product of a country with a very low gross national product or a gross domestic product. Let us realize that there are achievements, very great achievements, that are outside of the field of economics. Let us bear in mind that Darwin, who had an enormous effect on all social thought, was not equipped with a large remunerative staff. We have a large range of artistic and scientific achievement which still depend on separate human intelligence.
Look, this is a question I ask every guest at one point or another in our chats. You're in your 90s. Do you fear death?
Oh, I contemplate it occasionally, but I'm not going to allow fear of death to interfere with my few remaining months and years of life. If I contemplated that, I would destroy my enjoyment of what I have.
and you clearly enjoy life enormously.
Oh, I have enjoyed life almost without exception.
John Kenneth Galbraith will be 97 later this year and is still an emeritus professor at Harvard. The new biography of him by Richard Parker took 8 years to write. The publisher is Farrar, Straus and Giroux. And on the Background Briefing website, you can find a link to the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. You've been listening to Background Briefing. Coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Technical operator Mark Don. I'm Kirsten Garrett. And this is ABC Radio National.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs broadcast on more than 260 transmitters. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Live streaming on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcasts.